From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dion, a great singer who started in the doo-wop era. His hits included I Wonder Why, The Wanderer, and Run Around Sue. He has a new CD called Deja Nu. Dion brought his guitar to our studio. We'll hear him perform old songs, new songs, and blues and country songs that influenced him. Dion, coming up on Fresh Air.
Away from a runaround sewer. Whoa.
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Al Gore and George W. Bush meet for their final presidential debate tonight in St. Louis, one that will begin with a tribute to Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan, who was killed in a plane crash last night. Carnahan's widow says he would have wanted tonight's presidential debate to go on. But the governor's death has halted the Senate campaign of his rival, John Ashcroft, who says now's the time for the state to come together, and both Gore and Bush have canceled campaign events in Missouri. When Carnahan was killed, he was locked in a close race for the U.S. Senate, and by Missouri law, his name will remain on the November 7th ballot. From member station KSMU, Mike Smith reports.
The constitutional deadline for changing the ballot was last Friday, so Carnahan's name will appear as the Democratic nominee against Republican incumbent John Ashcroft. Missouri Secretary of State Becky Cook says if Carnahan gets more votes than Ashcroft, Missouri's acting governor could name an interim replacement to serve through the 2002 general election. But political science professor Denny Pilant of Southwest Missouri State University says federal law could complicate the matter.
The U.S. Senate can be the judge of the elections and returns and qualifications of its members. And if the Senate feels that any irregularity has occurred in Missouri, then they can refuse to seat an individual, you know, in the case that a dead man is elected.
Becky Cook says there's nothing that can be done to remove Carnahan's name from the ballot. For NPR News, I'm Mike Smith reporting.
In Oklahoma City, a state judge has disqualified Oklahoma County District Attorney Bob Macy and his entire prosecution team for pursuing a case against Oklahoma conspirator Terry Nichols. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
Terry Nichols has already been convicted and sentenced to life in prison without parole for his role in helping Timothy McVeigh blow up the Murrah Federal Building in 1995. Federal prosecutors won the conviction for conspiracy and manslaughter. But Oklahoma County Prosecutor Bob Macy vowed to bring Nichols to trial in Oklahoma and seek the death penalty. Yesterday, that promise was dealt a perhaps fatal setback when State District Judge Ray Dean Linder disqualified Macy in his office because of statements Macy made to the media after the judge had imposed a gag order. Macy told CBS, NPR, and the Daily Oklahoman that he felt death was the appropriate punishment for someone who had killed 19 babies. Judge Linder called Macy's comments improper and disqualifying, a blatant violation by a man I have known for over 40 years. Wade Goodwin, NPR News.
The U.S. ambassador to Yemen says the probe of the attack of the USS Cole has made a quantum leap forward. Barbara Bodine wouldn't directly confirm word from Yemeni officials that bomb-making equipment was found in an apartment near the port where the blast occurred. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials fell 149 points to 1089, and the Nasdaq was down 76. This is NPR News. Two French nationals who were kidnapped last week in Ecuador have escaped from their captors. Five Americans are still being held. From Bogota, Stephen Dudley reports.
According to Ecuadorian authorities, the Frenchmen managed to slip away from the three men guarding them as they were dumping the helicopter used to kidnap them near a river along the Colombian-Ecuadorian border. The two men, a pilot and a mechanic, then made their way to the Ecuadorian capital of Quito, where local law enforcement has them under tight security. The kidnappers are still holding an Argentinian, a Chilean, a New Zealander, and the five Americans somewhere along the contentious Colombian-Ecuadorian border. These men were working at an oil well owned by the Spanish energy firm Repsol YPF when unidentified gunmen surprised them and took them captive last Thursday. Ecuadorian authorities blamed the Colombian guerrilla group the FARC, but rebel leaders in Colombia denied they were involved in the crime. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Dudley in Bogota.
Forecasters say Michael has been upgraded to a hurricane. The storm is packing 75-mile-an-hour winds and is drifting about 400 miles west-southwest of Bermuda. Forecasters expect it to move north-northeast in the next day or so. A top health expert says the government should no longer make HIV-infected healthcare workers tell patients about their disease. Lawrence Gostin of Georgetown University Law Center says the rule poses significant human rights burdens on healthcare workers with HIV. He says recent data show the risk of transmission to patients is extremely low. Guidelines are being evaluated under a routine review by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Gostin's new proposal is in the Journal of the American Medical Association. A journal editorial says his proposal runs contrary to other evidence. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of 50 Acres and a Poodle, a memoir of love, livestock, and finding myself on a farm by Jean Marie Laskus.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you've ever dismissed Dion as a former teen idol whose talent or relevance didn't survive the oldies era, what you hear today is likely to change your mind. He's a great singer, deeply influenced by the blues and country music. Dion brought his guitar to our studio, and we're going to hear him perform some of his own songs and some of the songs that influenced him. Dion had his first hit, I Wonder Why, in 1958 with the doo-wop group The Belmonts, named after Belmont Avenue and the Bronx neighborhood in which they lived. His other hits included A Teenager in Love, Where or When, Donna the Prima Donna, Run Around Sue, The Wanderer, and Abraham Martin and John. His fan Bruce Springsteen gave the introduction when Dion was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1989. Dion sings a couple of Springsteen songs on his new CD, Deja Nu. It also features several songs that recall the doo-wop era. Here's the Springsteen song, If I Should Fall Behind.
We said we'd walk together, baby, come with me. Back come the twilight, should we lose our way? If as we were walking, our hands should slip free, I'll wait for you. Should I fall behind, wait for me. We swore that we would travel, darling, side by side, and we'd help each other to stay in stride. But each lover's step falls so differently. Girl, I'll wait for you. If I should fall behind, wait for me. Now everyone dreams of a love lasting and true.
Dion, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
What's it been like for you finding new material? I think a lot of people, when they think of your songs, they think of the songs you did when you were very young that were, some of them, very explicitly teenage songs, like Teenager in Love, or even
right.
The Wanderer. It's a song about, it's a song of a young man who in some ways is real hot stuff. I mean, you're not a teenager anymore, and the song that we just heard is a real adult song. Has it been difficult for you to find songs that reach your audience that you like and that are adult songs?
Well, I don't know. Songs to me have always been kind of like a diary. You know, say when I did Teenager in Love, maybe I was 16. Those questions in that song, even though it's a very simple song, and it seems like kind of claptrap or something, but it's not. To the unknowing ear, it would seem, you know, if you just listen to the surface of it. but it had a lot of heart, it had a lot of soul, and it asks some relevant questions that you could ask today, you know. And songs like I Wonder Why, it was the first hit record I had, you know, we didn't know how to write lyrics too good, but so we invented this kind of percussive rhythmic sound. You know, we'd make up these sounds. We'd go down to the Apollo Theater and hear the horn players, and we'd come back to the neighborhood and give the vocal group, I'd conjure, you know, I'd recruit guys and say, do this, do that, you know, and I'd try to get them to sound like the horn section down at the Apollo Theater. Like a song like Ruby Baby, I would, you know, I love a girl in a ruby, yes, her name. I have to go, Ruby, Ruby, Ruby Baby. It was like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They were like horns, you know. And all that stuff was arranged, you know, the group was a poor man's horn section on the street corners. That's what it was. Even when I did Run Around Sue, and they would hit, hit, dun da 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 hit, dun da 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 hit, hit, dun da da. That was a horn section that I heard at the Apollo Theater. I just brought it back to the streets and gave it to the guys to sing.
Let me go back to the beginning with you, when you were first listening to music. You wrote in your autobiography that Hank Williams really influenced you early on. When you were a kid, growing up in the Bronx, what did you hear in Hank Williams?
Well, Hank Williams seemed like so total to me, so committed to the lyric. He would actually rip the ends of the words off at the, you know, the end of the sentence. It sounded like he'd bite into the word and rip it off. You know, he would do like, well, I can't sing like him, but the kind of idea, like the first song I heard him do was like, and I left my home down on the rural route, told my pa I was going to step out and get the honky-tonk blues, yeah, the honky-tonk blues, well, Lord, I got them. The honky-tonk blues. You know, he said, I'd stop into every place in town. And he'd rip the word right off like, I got it, and there it goes. You know, and he was totally committed, physically, lyrically, musically, spiritually. I just said, what's this guy talking about? You know, just... And see, I had a guy on the streets that really helped me out a lot, too. There was a guy in Bronx, New York City, his name was Willie Green, and he was the superintendent of a tenement building in my neighborhood. And, you know, basically what I do is like black music filtered through an Italian neighborhood comes out with an attitude, yo. So Willie Green would be playing me all this John Lee Hooker stuff and, you know, Sonny Boy Williamson, and he'd be playing like... Going down the road, stop at Fannie Mae. Tell my baby what I heard her boyfriend say. Don't stop me talking. Why, Lord, tell everything I know. I'm gonna break up the signifying. Why, Lord, Jack, and some people got to go. Jack gave his wife $5, go downtown, get some, you know, he'd do stuff like that, or, yeah, and I woke up this morning, round for my shoes, yeah, some telling me child got to do the walking blue, yeah, woke up this morning, looking around for my shoes, child, you know that I live this morning. Some people tell me that their worry blues ain't bad, that worse so feeling I'm on ever care, son. People tell me that their worry blues ain't bad, child, no. Oh, but that worse so feeling I'm on ever care, child, no, no, no. And I'm a walking stuff like that. So I'd go into the studio and do the white version of that.
Well, no, really, but it sounds like what I'm hearing from you is that you heard country music through Hank Williams. You heard all these blues recordings.
Right.
And what you found was this kind of
and
Bronx version.
And a little doo-wop.
Yeah, that doo-wop was that for you. This really, like for you, native version of all the music that you were loving.
Right, it kind of...
But it was authentic because it was your music. You weren't just doing stuff in the manner of somebody else.
Well, Willie Green, again, the guy who was doing this, he told me, he said, Dion, he said, write about the people in the neighborhood. Write about the things you know. And to me, when I looked around my neighborhood, we had characters like Frankie Yunk Yunk, Joe Beebe Eyes, Ralphie Moach. There was a guy in my neighborhood, they called him Shakespeare. He used to say, like, to be or not to be, which is my apartment? I thought I'd get you with that, Terry. But we had a lot of characters, you know, so, and they seemed bigger than life. Like the Wanderer, his name was Jackie Burns. He was a sailor who got tattoos all over him, you know. And every time he'd date a girl, he'd get a name tattooed on his body, you know. This guy was like, you know, Flow on my left arm, Mary on my right, Janie is a girl I'll be with tonight. Little girl asked me which one I love the best. I tear open my shirt, I show Rosie on my chest. I'm a wanderer, yeah, I'm the wanderer. I roam around, 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 around. Play that thing every year now. But this guy would walk around with his tank top on with all these names all over, you know.
What'd you think of him? Did you like him, or?
He was kind of a loner. He would like, I didn't know him that well. But he just seemed bigger than life because he was older than me and he was in the Navy.
Right.
And he would come back and he'd have this kind of, you know, and I kind of featured myself, you know, kind of, like a street corner poet, you know, burnt to the bone with the fire of this new rock and roll music. So I was like, you know, over there saying, what could this guy, you know, like, how could we put this guy to music, you know? And I don't think he ever knew the song was about him. He took off for, see, I don't know if he's alive today, but The Wanderer is a sad song. It says, I roam from town to town. I go through life without a care. I'm as happy as a clown with my two fists of iron, but I'm going nowhere. It's about a guy who just is stuck in a very kind of shallow lifestyle, you know?
Before you started listening to rhythm and blues and blues music and stuff like that, I know when you were 11, you used to sing in a bar in your neighborhood, and it sounded like you were a real local attraction. What did you sing when you were 11?
Ah, yeah. I would do... I knew 70 Hank Williams songs. Would you believe that? I would even sing his Luke the Drifter series. You know, in the world's mighty gallery of pictures hang the scenes that are painted from life. I was like 13 years old. I thought I was a philosopher. I didn't even know what I was singing about. I sang Honky Tonk Blues. I sang Jambalaya. If you... An Italian from the Bronx, I had no idea what jambalaya meant, but it sounded so good and felt so good coming out of my mouth, you know? Goodbye, Joe, me gotta go, me oh my oh. You know, jambalaya, crawfish pie, and a filly gumbo. I didn't know what gumbo was. I knew what rigatoni was, but gumbo, I had no idea. And, you know, I got caught up in this music, and it I guess it's like anybody else when you get caught up into something, it just took me away.
Why don't we pause here and listen to the first Dion and the Belmonts recording, which is I Wonder Why, with those great harmonies.
That's a good attitude song.
Yeah, let's hear it. And what year is this, Dion?
This is 57 beginning.
And you were how old?
I was 17.
Okay, let's hear it.
Now I love you like I do. Now I do.
My guest is Dion. He has a new CD called Deja Nu. We'll be back with more music and conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. One of my favorite types of interviews is what I've come to think of as the singing autobiography, where we combine performance and interview in an informal way. We can do this on Fresh Air because public radio makes it possible to do long-form interviews or concerts. My reasons for working in public radio are probably the same reasons you like to listen. For example, there's time to go into things in depth, whether the subject is rock and roll, the presidential debates, or the Middle East. There's nothing else remotely like public radio on the radio. That's why I can say with confidence that I think this service is worthy of your financial support. Please call now. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview and performance with Dion. He has a new CD called Deja Nu. There's a song that you wrote on the new CD that I really want to play because I think your singing now is really similar to what it's always been. I think some of the material has changed, but I think your singing still has everything in it that you've been talking about, all those influences, the urgency that you've been talking about. So let me play a song from the new CD, but before I do, I want you to introduce it for us. And this is called Every Day That I'm With You. Tell us about writing this. What inspired it?
Well, this is a story, but I'm going to tell it. The CD's called Deja Nu, and the song that you're about to play, in fact, the whole CD, all the songs in it are a movie soundtrack for a movie called The Wanderer that Chaz Palminteri wrote a screenplay for. And I was writing these songs for different scenes in the movie. The movie got bogged down this year, so I just released the CD. But anyway, every song on the CD is written for a certain, piece of the movie. This song was written for a montage scene in the middle of it. I traveled with Buddy Holly and Richie Valens on that tour. We were co-headlining a tour, and we were on this little yellow school bus, not one of these luxury line custom-made coaches today. It was just a yellow school bus. We were riding through the Midwest in 1959, February of 1959. It was cold. It was like 30 below zero. We were freezing. But we really kind of bonded on this tour, Richie, Buddy, and myself, because we had the first Fender guitars that were issued, these new Stratocasters, and we were in a kind of a competition to see who would make them ring the longest. And 2 weeks into the tour, Buddy got kind of fed up with the bus breaking down, and he was trying to recruit people. He chartered a plane. And he said, because the more people you get aboard, the less it would cost. So he said, it'll be $36, he tells me. And he hit the magic number for me. I grew up with my parents screaming and yelling at each other for the rent in Bronx, New York City at the time was $36. So my mind hadn't stretched out to that place where I could spend the whole month's rent on a 45-minute plane flight to Fargo, North Dakota. So I said, no. So he gives me his guitar. He says, here, he says, take care of my guitar. He says, and you better take care of it. So he took his laundry. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to get a haircut. He wanted to do his laundry. Gives me the guitar to take care of. So now I wonder how his guitar sounds compared to mine. So I go in the dressing room and I take the guitar. I'll plug it in. And I'm saying, I was telling Chaz Palminteri as he's writing this story around this book, The Wanderer, that I wrote. And the movie was called The Wanderer. So he said, we could do a Buddy Holly song here in the movie, like It Doesn't Matter Anymore. I said, let me write something to go through me sitting in the dressing room playing his guitar and singing with it. And while this scene takes place of them leaving, us driving to Fargo, arriving the next morning. So this song was written for that scene because I thought I could capture this thing. Because in my heart, I've always wanted to express this relationship that, that I pondered at times or reflected on at times that I had with Buddy Holly, and it came out in this song.
And I just want to say for our listeners who don't know the end of the story that Buddy Holly took this plane that you decided not to take. The plane crashed, killing Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper.
Right.
So the other thing is, so Chaz Palminteri's movie is your biography? That's what he's trying
to
say?
Yeah, he wrote a screenplay around this,
autobiography, The Wanderer.
Right.
All right.
So well, that's what this whole album is. It's actually a soundtrack. In fact,
it's a soundtrack of your life.
I don't think it would have came out as good if I tried to write songs and put out an album. I kind of did it inadvertently. I kind of backed into it,
right.
You know, and it's interesting the way it came out, you know.
So let's hear Every Day That I'm With You, the song that's, I guess, inspired by Buddy Holly and
yes,
about that
absolutely
chapter of your life. This is a song written and performed by Dion from his new CD, Deja Nu. Dion will be back in the second half of the show. He has a new CD called Deja Nu. I'm Terry Gross, you're listening to Fresh Air, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Oh, and I'm the type of guy who will never settle down. Where pretty girls are, well, you know that I'm around. I kiss them and I love them, cause to me they're all the same. I hug them and I squeeze them, they don't even know my name. They call me the Wanderer.
Coming up, more music and conversation with Dion.
Oh, well, there's Flo on my left arm, and there's Mary on my right, and Janie is the girl, well, that I'll be with tonight. And when she asks me which one I love the best, I tear open my shirt and I show a rosy on my chest, cause I'm a wanderer.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Saab, introducing its new 2001 lineup with the OnStar communication system. Information available at saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dion. He has a new CD called Deja Nu. He wrote several of the songs for a movie about his life that's in the works, written by Chaz Palminteri. Dion's early hits included I Wonder Why, Teenager in Love, The Wanderer, and Runaround Sue. In 1959, he toured with Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper. Dion declined to join the other three on a chartered plane to their next concert and chose the cheaper option, the bus. Because of that decision, he was spared from being killed in the most infamous plane crash in rock history. A couple of songs on this new CD are inspired by the period of your life in which you knew Buddy Holly. How did it change your life to know that you came just like an inch away from dying in that plane crash with him? I mean, that's got to give you pause and make you think that every day is a kind of gift after that.
Well, in some kind, I was 19 years old when that happened, and the rug was ripped out from under me. I was in shock. In fact, when I got home, my girlfriend, who's been my wife all these years, at the time she was my girlfriend, she said, "You were in shock for like 2 weeks. You stayed in a room singing Buddy Holly and Richie Valens songs." But I think, you know, at that age, basically, I was baffled because this was the best thing that ever happened to me, being on tour with these guys, running around the country singing rock and roll. I was like, you know, I felt like, wow, what a good thing this is. You know, what fun, what, you know, seeing the world, new friends, you know, there was nothing like it. And then all of a sudden, I'm wondering, what's this about? Where am I going? Why am I here? Who am I? What, you know, I'm starting to ask questions that I really, they're probably floating around your head, but you don't, you know, they're not clear. But I knew God had a plan for my life right then, but I started thinking on a higher reality, you know, after that. I started seeking, like, truth and freedom and God and, you know, what's this about? You know, why are we here? And that's been a journey for me, and it's been a wonderful journey.
Did you fly much after that?
I flew home. I wanted to get, for some reason, I knew I had to get over it right away, so I flew home. And but a lot of things weren't worked out, because when I got back to the Bronx, there was no one that said, what are your feelings about the, you know? They went, hey, you know, came into our neighborhood the other day, we're going to kick his teeth out. Are you coming with us or not? You know, and that was that. I mean, nobody cared. You know, I was out in the Midwest like alone, you know. So I never really... put a lot of these questions, you know, a lot of these things to rest. I had to go off alone to, like, you know, work them out, you know.
But that's an interesting point that you brought up. I mean, the music that you started performing when you were young was so much a part of your neighborhood, both the people you started performing it with initially and the kind of sound that it was. And then you became really famous, and when you become famous, you might become a hero in your neighborhood, but you're also separated from the people because you're living in a different world. Suddenly you have money, you have fame, you have different kinds of friends, you have professional connections.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. But there's a part of me that never left the... my neighborhood... my upbringing became more important and more valuable to me as I got older. I appreciate the people, like even the priest who told me, like early on in my career when I was walking down the streets thinking I was the rebel king of the neighborhood, he said, "Yo, Dion, come over here, Father Joe." He said, "What's this rebel without a cause?" You know, that James Dean movie was out. He said, "You know, when you stand up for the truth, you really got something, you know." I didn't know what he was talking about, but he was telling, you know. But you see, he was the true rebel. He was the true radical one in the neighborhood. I didn't know that, so I had to, you know, these things you learn as you, you know. I'm glad I'm around this long, because, like, you find these little treasures.
At the same period when, you know, Buddy Holly dies, you start thinking more about the larger meaning of things, the direction you really want to be heading. It was also during the period when you were doing heroin. So I'm wondering if how the heroin connected or didn't connect with this sense of looking for something larger.
Well, yeah, you're trying to find something and trying to fill up that place in you that needs filling, and sometimes you go to the wrong places, you know. But when I look back on some of my records now, it's really funny. I see a kid who, you know, here's Chuck Berry singing about school, singing about cars, even though they were, you know, maybe weren't, you know, it was more than cars. But, you know, singing about all these kind of things. I'm singing like, "I live in dreams, strange as it seems, love came to me. When I opened my eyes, I realized love came," you know. I wrote a song called Born to Cry that I say, what was I writing of it? What was I thinking? I mean, they're really heavy. They're not very light songs. They're very introspective songs. And I could see how I was trying to work out some of these things. And the music was a real, outlet for me, like salvation in a way.
Born to Cry isn't one of your more famous songs. Would you do a little bit of it for us?
Well, here's a song, yeah. I'd like to tell you all about the good and the bad. I wish today the world, my friends, would stop being sad. There's so much evil around us, I feel that I could die. And I know that I was born to cry. If I ever told you all about the things I have done, I don't remember having even one day of fun. The things I like and want to have, I can't even buy. And I know that I was born to cry. See, I blew it.
That's great, though. While we're on the subject of these kind of deep feelings that you're having and trying to translate into songs, let me ask you about something that you also had to do at the same time. Just the other day on TV, I was watching Don't Knock the Twist, one of the rock and roll movies with, you know, Chubby Checker, and it's all about, like, the twist becoming a dance craze. And, of course, you're featured doing The Majestic and The Wanderer in two of the nightclub scenes. And there's one scene where everybody's on stage doing the twist, and you're on stage looking like, what am I doing here?
Well, that's exactly what I was feeling, because here you have a scene where people are sitting at, like, tables in a nightclub, you know, all dressed up, and they wouldn't let you use any black musicians on stage. The white performers had a white band. Chubby Checker had a black band because the movie wouldn't get played. You go from south of Baltimore, it wouldn't get played. So, and all I had on my records were black musicians from the Apollo. They played The Wanderer, Run Around Sue, all those records. The guys like Styx Evans and Panama Francis and Buddy Lucas, all these great musicians at that time. But it was here. You have these really white bread guys on stage going do do do, you know, and you have these people sitting at tables. Meanwhile, the song, like Run Around Sue, doesn't look anything like it is, because it was born on the street corners, in the schoolyards, banging on cardboard boxes, and guys chanting. And with jeans on and with attitude, it didn't look like it looks like in those movies. So I still, when they have these doo-wop shows, I still get, what are they doing? They look like wedding bands. That wasn't the way it was. The music was street music, and it just looks so funny dressed up like that to me.
My guest is Dion. He has a new CD called Deja Nu. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dion. He has a new CD called Deja Nu. Why don't we hear Book of Dreams, a Springsteen song that you do on your new CD. Tell us how you ended up doing this particular Springsteen song. What was his occasion for writing it? How did you get it? And where does it fit into the story of your life?
Book of Dreams is such a special song. I wanted to put it in the movie for a wedding song, because it's written four-dimensionally. Like, there's one verse about the present, one about the future, one about the past, and one about one that happens in your imagination. So it's almost like adult doo-wop music, you know? I recorded this album with all the same techniques and equipment I recorded The Wanderer with. It sounds like, being it's a soundtrack to a movie, it sounds like it was recorded in the 50s or 1960 and somebody forgot to release it. And so it sounds like that, but yet the lyrics just bring a little, pushes it a little, you know, so it has a little extra dimension to it.
Well, this is Bruce Springsteen's song, Book of Dreams, sung by Dion on Dion's new CD, Deja New.
I'm standing in the backyard, listening to the party inside. Tonight I'm drinking in forgiveness this life provides. The scars we carry remain, but the pain slips away, it seems. Oh, won't you, baby, be in my book of dreams? I'm watching you through the window with your girlfriends from back home. You're showing off your dress, there's laughter and a toast. From your daddy to the prettiest bride that he's ever seen. Oh, won't you, baby, in my book. Darkness, my fingers slip across your skin. I feel your sweet reply, the room fades away, and I'm way up high. Just holding you to me as through the window, the moonlight streams. Oh, won't you, baby, be in my book of dreams?
That's Dion from his new CD, Deja Nu. The song is by Bruce Springsteen. Dion, what did you mean before when you were saying that you used all the same equipment and techniques that you did on your early records?
Well, we recorded this album with tube mics and the same equipment that I used on maybe Teenager in Love, The Wanderer, Run Around Sue. It sounds like it was recorded right in between those records. We ran the vocals through the hallway. We used the same. That's what we did in the 50s. We didn't have, you know, we didn't have effects. So we invented stuff, you know. And we did it live. Everything leaks into everybody's mic. You know, back then, if you come into the studio with a band and didn't get it done, it didn't get done. It just had to happen. You had to capture that magic right there. So we went in and let it rip, you know.
There was a period of your life when all of your recordings were coming out on a Christian record label. You had gone through a spiritual awakening, were born again. And I'm wondering if that period when all of your records were on the Christian label, was that because that's the only kind of material you wanted to record, or is that the only place where you were finding a place to record?
No, it's what I wanted to record at the time. But I tell you, gospel music is very uplifting. It's great. It's just a lot of fun to write, and it's wonderful for the heart, soul, mind, and spirit. It's just great. So I was, my faith had come alive. You know, I grew up Catholic, you know. Well, I would say I had a mild Catholic upbringing. But, you see all these beautiful signs and these traditions and all these beautiful ceremonies, but you don't realize that they're a visible sign pointing to a higher reality. And one day, my faith came alive. It just came alive. And I just wanted to, you know, I've always had passion, and it always came out musically. It was one of the gifts that God gave me to express it. And so I always, instead of moaning and groaning and being in my concerns, you know, look what these people are, look what, I like to be influential, affect change, at least through music, like a song like Abraham, Martin, and John, just to have people think about things where they could ask themselves the right questions. If you don't ask yourself the right questions, you're going to get stuck. So music is a wonderful tool to stir up some change in people's thinking. So writing some of this material for me was just, like I wrote a song called, remember that story I told you about Father Joe?
Yeah.
He said, when you stand up for truth. Well, I wrote this song. I saw the verse in scripture. It said, the truth will set you free. So I wrote this song. I'll do a verse.
Great.
Down the dirty city streets, with black top sneakers on my feet, I raced through early teenage years and dealt with all those nameless fears, waiting as the school bell rang to drop my books and join the gang in alley fights and stickball games where passing girls wore dirty names. Over my shoulder and back through the years, I can see my father's eyes in my memory, telling me Jesus died upon the cross, war was won and nothing lost. And son, the truth will set you free. Yeah, the truth will set you free. You know I turn my collar, I comb my hair, my high school friends are all dead. When two dimes made my pockets ring, I was a wealthy New York king. Being cool by the candy store, I knew my world yet wanted more. My high school colors of black and blue, they would disturb my point of view.
That sounded really great. Do you still perform that? Do you do any of your gospel songs at concerts now?
I just kind of do Dion music. You know, if one year I'll go out, maybe do two gospel songs. Some years I go out. I don't know. I just put shows together.
Well, Dion, this has been a really special session. It's just been wonderful to hear you play music from the past and the present. I want to thank you very, very much. I'd like to close with another track from your new CD, and the CD is called Deja Nu. Let's close with the opening track, which is called Shoebop. Would you introduce it for us?
Well, can I tell a little story about it?
Yeah.
Shoebop was written right on the street corners of the Bronx. I was with Chaz Palminteri, and I was saying, you know, in this scene in the movie, we could have these guys singing this. And I started writing it right there, so you could play it.
Dion, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And this is from Dion's new CD, Deja Nu.
I had to find a way to make you look my way.
music from Dion's new CD, Deja Nu. This is Fresh Air. We hope you've heard some of your favorite performers on Fresh Air, and that you've sometimes been surprised by what you've heard. Let me explain something about how Fresh Air works. Each station that broadcasts our show has to pay a subscription fee, and that fee goes toward our production budget. During this fundraiser, your station needs Fresh Air listeners to pledge at least enough money for the station to pay the fee. Otherwise, the station won't be able to afford to bring you Fresh Air. So there's a direct correlation between your pledge of financial support and your continued ability to hear Fresh Air. I hope you'll call with a pledge. Thank you. Like a lot of people, our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening to the presidential debates. But for Jeff, it's as much about how the candidates speak as what they have to say.
I know what I'd tell Al Gore if I were an advisor concerned about people's perception of him as stiff and formal. Just two words, only contract. When you're listening to the debate tonight, count how many times Gore contracts have or be when the context would allow it. In the first two debates, he was only doing it around 45% of the time. He doesn't just pronounce every word, he pronounces the spaces between them. I think that is the wrong choice. We have got to balance the budget. That same feature probably has a lot to do with people's impression of George Bush's kickback conviviality. The man contracts between 85 and 90% of the time when the verb isn't emphasized. Words like I'm and theirs, I'm not even sure if Bush knows they have apostrophes in them. For Bush, going to is pronounced gonna, or even mona, as in, I'm mona trust them. And Gore's we have got to always shows up in Bush's mouth as we gotta. We gotta ban partial birth abortions. We gotta make sure our seniors get the promise made. Of course, everybody uses gotta informally, but in a televised debate, it's what actors call a choice. Actually, when I looked up the transcript of the debate the next day on the CNN website, it turned out they'd changed most of Bush's gottas to need tos. That's a fair enough edit, since we gotta looks pretty rough on the page. But Gore doesn't need those editorial cleanups. The speech differences are all the more striking when you think that we've never had two presidential candidates whose linguistic backgrounds were so similar, at least on the face of things. Bush and Gore both grew up in Washington political families, both spent their youth going back and forth between southern states and northeastern prep schools, and both went to Ivy League universities before returning home. Unlike the other Southerners who've run for national office in the last 50 years, both men came by their accents in a more or less deliberate way. If we want to explain the differences, then, we'd have to start way back, or way deep. Maybe it begins with the fathers that each was named after. Senator Albert Gore Sr. was the son of a hardscrabble farmer from Possum Hollow, Tennessee. That was country before country was cool, and by all accounts, Gore Sr. was highly self-conscious about his language. He practiced his elocution and used words he found in the dictionary. And as a famously demanding father, it isn't likely he would have tolerated any gonas or gottas around the family dinner table. It's a fastidiousness that Al Jr. finds it hard to break with. He can cultivate that accent and make a sedulous effort to drop his G's. But people still find it difficult to get his name in the same sentence as the word homespun, and nobody's ever going to refer to him as Tennessee Al. Al Gore Sr. is a far cry from George Herbert Walker Bush, himself the son of a senator from a patrician Connecticut family. As a young man, it's true, George W. had ambivalent feelings about assuming that New England mantle of noblesse oblige. And that youthful rebellion is evident in the extravagant embrace of Texas vowels. In fact, the other day I was listening to a C-SPAN rebroadcast of the 1988 vice presidential debate, and it struck me that Bush's accent's a lot thicker than Lloyd Benson's. But then, Benson was born and educated in Texas, not Connecticut, and he didn't have anything to prove. But George W. got one linguistic legacy from his father that didn't have to be taken in for a new climate, his nonchalant ungrammaticality. It's the hallmark of the old WASP establishment, a class that regards taking pains with language as the unerring signal of somebody who's trying too hard. As it turns out, it was a happy accident for W. The tousled syntax that served the Bushes well at Andover and Kennebunkport turned out to be just the thing for campaigning in West Texas, none of them places that value an excessive attention to subject-verb agreement. There's a lot of procedures that have not kept up. There's no prescription drug benefits. There's no drug therapies. There's no preventing medicines. Of course, Bush Jr. sometimes tries to rise to the occasion the same way Gore Jr. tries to sink to it. When W. wants to sound presidential, he'll try to construct a sentence that suggests some grander sense of mission, what his father used to call the vision thing. But it's like somebody assembling a barbecue. When the sentence is finished, there are always half a dozen parts left over. It's odd that neither candidate has been able to overcome those early influences. It gives you a new appreciation for politicians who have that capacity to create a resonant public voice while preserving the illusion of intimate speech. Clinton does it brilliantly, of course. And so did Reagan. His syntax might have been shaky on occasion, but unlike either of the Bushes, he usually got to the end of his sentences around the same time the period did. When you see how difficult it is for the present candidates to achieve that effect, you realize how early in life Clinton and Reagan's self-fashioning must have begun. I don't know where the gift comes from exactly, but it probably doesn't help to have a strong father.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our Dion interview in concert was produced by Amy Sallet and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, some of the history leading up to the latest Israeli-Palestinian crisis. We talk with Rami Kouri, syndicated columnist and former editor of the Jordan Times, and Danny Rubenstein, columnist and member of the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Join us for the next Fresh Air.